Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Pure Hoops podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Pure Hoops podcast most definitely does reflect the views of our management. Here's three-time NBA champ BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman.
The Pure Hoops Podcast. I know life right now feels a bit like the Twilight Zone. It does for me here in Manhattan. BJ Armstrong in LA. My man, how are you doing after this very surreal, strange week in the life of not just everyone in America, but many around the globe?
Yeah, we can't complain, and you know, we're being socially responsible, you know, with the keeping our social distancing and doing all the things that we can in the Armstrong household. So we take this very serious here, and our company Wasserman, everyone's working from home, and the great part is, you know, in talking to the players, all of our clients all around the world, and some of our clients have actually returned back to work back in China. All of our clients who play professionally in China returned back to work this week. So we're getting an opportunity, Eric, to see how, you know, we're watching how the different sports here in our country are dealing with it. But I'm getting a chance to speak to all of the different leagues, whether it's Euro League, Euro Cup, what have you, in all the different regions, all the different countries. And in that part of the world that we're discussing now, in China, they returned back to play this week, and all the players were excited. They felt very comfortable, and they were excited to get back and start playing and start back getting back on the court this week.
Well, that's a positive for sure. So before we pivot to our esteemed guest today, you shared a bit about many of these conversations that you started to have last week, where you're trying to figure out who needs to get home, who's where, what decisions are being made. Without naming names, if you're not comfortable, were there any insightful or eye-opening conversations you had this week, whether it was from the world of basketball, health, government? I know you're talking to so many people about what's going on right now.
Well, yeah, you know, the one thing is you try to separate, you know, you try to get everyone the facts and you try to get everyone the correct information. And that's been the biggest part, as I think people want to know what they can do to help. And if anything has been amazing, is that how everyone is understanding. And I think probably more so people who actually work in large gatherings like we work in, which are arenas and travel and so forth. So we're beginning to really understand how connected we all are. And It's been amazing to watch that, because in dealing with all of the leagues and countries and people that we have to deal with, it's been amazing to watch how people are working with each other to really get this done. And when I say get it done, to really try to play their part and really, you know, be proactive in what we can do to assist and really getting this virus contained so that we can move on.
As always on our podcast and all of our podcasts, really, we try to have some essential voices on regardless of the subject matter. And, you know, BJ, we've been fortunate enough to meet a lot of really unique and great people through the game. And our guest today is someone that I've known for close to 10 years. Obviously, your journey in the league spans a lot longer than that. And pleased to welcome the one and only Bob Delaney to the show. Former NBA official, 1,700-plus regular season games, 200 playoff games,
nine NBA finals, also a former New Jersey State Trooper, an undercover officer, and I think most importantly in today's climate has also provided PTSD training to officers on the federal, state, and local level, along with veterans. Bob Delaney, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure to be with you guys.
So, Bob, obviously, first and foremost, what's on everyone's mind right now around the clock is this coronavirus epidemic. And before we get to some of the things that happened regarding the NBA, you have such a wide variety of experiences, especially with law enforcement and knowing how state and federal authorities handle things. What's been your response and your perspective on both federal and state leaders responding to what is now a serious pandemic crisis here in the United States?
Yeah, Eric, as you started to speak and you read off some of my background, one thing that stuck in my head is I can't hold a job. I'm bouncing from one place to the next. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to laugh. We cannot lose our sense of humor in these situations. I've learned that in the crisis management work that I've done on the law enforcement side, working with the military, being in war zones, visiting our troops, being embedded with the 25th Infantry in Mosul, been through Iraq, Afghanistan. And one thing I do learn from them is that they are the greatest team that I've ever been around. I'm around the world champions, as you guys are, of sports. But these folks are the world champions of the game of life. And so learning from them is important. They keep their sense of humor. They're flexible. They're innovative. They're adaptive. Let's just think back to the Bin Laden capture kill, about what the plan was and how it went awry, but they still completed their mission. I believe we're going to do the same thing here. We have plenty of time to Monday morning quarterback, which all of us in sports are used to.
Yep.
Right now, it's about the fight that we're in. And fighting for each other is what's most important from my view.
You know, Bob, I don't know if I've ever shared this with you. My father, my dad, was a referee, and now he's the head of the officials in the state of Michigan.
Basketball.
Yeah, and I've always had a great appreciation for officials because I knew my dad was always trying to be the best, right? And when he would miss a call, you know, it would just eat him up, or he thought he could do a better job. You refereeing at the professional level for so many years at that level with the greatest athletes of the world, what are some of the qualities, or share some of the qualities, what do you think that makes a great official?
Well, I think that there has to be a level of confidence, like anything. And there's a difference between confidence and arrogance. I always want the pilots, I fly a lot, and I want the pilots to have their confidence. I don't want them to be arrogant. I want them to be assured of what they're doing. But I also want to make sure they know a checkoff list and that they're going through everything possible to make sure that that flight is safe. I think we all need to do that in whatever our professions are. And I think in this situation, again, I would underline that hope is extremely important, but not false hope. So the same thing when I was supervising officials, you know, I always said to them, be careful what you ask for, because most people want honest feedback until they get it. And then it's a whole different ballgame than it's yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. Our willingness to listen, our willingness to be led at this time does not mean we're followers. It means we're great leaders as well. Great leaders are willing to be led. And I see that in the great officials. They're willing to have critiquing take place. They're willing to have someone else view their game and point out how they could be even better. They are self-critiquing at a high level. But I don't think that's just for officials. I think that's for every walk of life. Those who are successful simply do what unsuccessful people are unwilling to do. You have to pay a price to be successful. It doesn't just come. You don't just show up on a Sunday afternoon working at Celtics Lakers. it's a path that gets you there. And there's ups and downs. There's ups and downs in the game of life. We're going through one now. We are being tested. There is no testimony without a test. This test that we have before us is no different than the tests that we have had generations upon generations. And I am confident that we will come out the other side stronger and better. What we need to do is listen to the authorities and have a willingness to shelter in place, minimize your interactions with other folks until this gets under control. And that's not that difficult. It may be disruptive to our lives, but it's not difficult. I can't imagine that anyone is going to say that's impossible for me to do. That would just be a selfish person in my mind.
Bob, you talk about people being challenged and healthcare workers right now are on the front lines. You've dealt with so many different people on the front lines before. The perspective of healthcare workers, the impact that law enforcement can have in trying to assist them. How are you looking at this right now? Because there is no precedence for this. This is new. This is different. We've seen police officers. We've seen military. Now we've got healthcare workers on the front line. How do you see this? And how do regular people and how does law enforcement help healthcare workers through this?
Yeah, it's a tribute to the human spirit. It's amazing how when times like this take place, those who serve are willing to go to the problem, whether it be the Twin Towers, whether it be a holdup and robbery in a bank, whether it be a fire. There are people in our society that are charged with that responsibility and take it very seriously. And I think that a newfound respect will come for every one of those walks of life. Unfortunately, it takes these kinds of things to remind us of how generous people are with who they are, because they put their own lives on hold. They put their families on hold, and they're serving 24/7. You are going to have cops come down with this because they're exposed. Firefighters, those that serve, the men and women that are doctors and are healthcare. I'm currently attending Harvard Global Mental Health Trauma Recovery Program, which started in Orvieto, Italy in November for 18 days, where we had classes and projects and lectures from professors around the world. And I'm one of a member of 70 in a cohort, and most of them are doctors from around the world working with sex trafficking, refugee camps, and a variety of issues. And in hearing what they're going through right now and the lack of equipment that is available to them, and yet they're putting scarves on and doing their jobs, is just nothing less than heroic. And we are fortunate that we have folks like this around the world.
So, Bob, right now, professional level, what's your biggest worry?
A professional level from the law enforcement side of taking a view of this, or from sports world?
I'd say law enforcement and healthcare.
The biggest concern I have is that people put, you know, the everyday person is going to put somebody in harm's way. So walking around on a beach in Florida right now because you think it's your spring break, that's just being selfish. You thinking that you should be able to go out and have your good times, that's being selfish. Thinking that this is not impacting young people is fool's gold. At some point, it's going to, whether you're a carrier or so. Listening, taking advice of what's being said to us. I mean, I do not miss one of Dr. Anthony Fauci's statements. That man is brilliant, and he's a leader.
Yep.
And he's giving us information that we should listen to. Unfortunately, we all think that, you know, I lived in a world where everybody sitting on a couch thought they could do my job better. And I understood that. But it never dawned on me to walk into a dentist office as they're working on me and say, why are you using that tool, or why are you giving me that Novocaine? Why don't you do this? For some reason, folks think that they know more than everybody else today. I don't know if it's whether it's social media or whatever it is, but our willingness to listen and be led in times of crisis is what will help push this situation, this crisis down. Allow those who have the authority and the expertise to lead us.
Before we go down the NBA storytelling lane, which obviously, you know, both of us love to do, just quickly, you have such knowledge of the league and their inner workings and how they make big decisions. The NBA response to the coronavirus, when you heard about Rudy Gobert testing positive, what was your reaction on how things were handled and your reaction to the fact, okay, this is now in the NBA, it's time to start making some critical decisions here?
Yeah, as you know, I'm still hold the title as NBA Cares Ambassador, but that's my only involvement with the NBA today. And so in 2017, I left the position as Vice President, Referee Director, Referee Operation Director of Officials. And shortly after that, Greg Sankey offered me a position, created a position with the Southeastern Conference. So a special advisor for officiating development performance for all sports there, but obviously with my background, spend more time with basketball, do other things. There. And so we were in Nashville at that time. This was all taking place with the SEC tournament and brainstorming a meeting and decisions being made about where we were going with our tournament, and was aware of what was taking place with the NBA. And I think what we saw was true leadership. Leadership comes in many forms, many ways. I had the good fortune of working for David Stern and Adam Silver. And I think that their leadership, that leadership that comes from the NBA, made this at a higher level of understanding for the United States. Once that decision was made, Gobert has apologized, and rightfully so. I mean, his actions were not actions that you would hope somebody would take. It was thinking it was a joke or, a very laissez-faire kind of attitude to the original directives that were being given by the NBA. But again, it's Monday morning quarterback. I mean, let's move forward. The decision that was made there influenced the United States in a huge, huge way. I'll go one step further. It influenced the world. That influenced the world. And it saved lives. Those decisions are not easy ones. And you can imagine the angst that was going on inside of the commissioner, inside of all those on his team. Because I was experiencing it with Commissioner Sankey in real time. And his leadership was also one that will be looked upon down the road as being great ways to study leadership. Because when we unfold and peel all this stuff back, we're going to learn from all this in so many ways. But I think that the NBA's actions was outstanding, truly servant leadership and caring about our fellow man versus about what that business responsibility was.
But if we could look into the future, how do you think sports will be different when they finally do return? What do you think will be some of the things that we will learn from this, as you mentioned earlier?
Well, I think we learn from everything, right? I mean, baseball's going to more and more mesh fencing along the lines because of people becoming injured, foul balls and bats going into the stands. And so change doesn't come fast, and change feels awkward. You know, I'll ask you guys and your audience members just to do me a favor. Just just fold your arms. If you fold your arms in front of you, you do it a certain way. I put my right hand over the big gun I got on the left side, and then I hide my other hand under the right arm monster gun that I have on the other. But I ask you to do it just the opposite. Put your right where your left is and where your left where your right is. And it's going to feel awkward. Yeah, if I asked you to do that for 30 minutes a day for the next 30 days and we came back together, you may not fold it in the new way, but it will not feel awkward and it will not feel strange. So change takes time, and change will come. You know, as you said, you know, I came in the league in the 80s. When I go off the plane, I was looking for a payphone. Today, I got a phone in my pocket. Times change. And so our willingness to allow it to change and our awareness that change is needed is extremely important. That flexibility, that innovative, adaptive kind of approach that I referred to early in our time on the phone is important.
You just have me flashing back now looking for a payphone when I was a kid before cell phones existed. That's amazing. You know, Bob, a lot of speculation about there on, you know, when normalcy could be, when the NBA can resume the season. I mean, mm-hmm. It's crazy to even think about trying to forecast that right now, knowing what's going on in New York, where I sit, California, where BJ sits, Florida, where you sit. Forget timelines, but you know, what conditions do you think we need to see before the NBA and all of the things that come with it can resume with what will unfortunately have to be a new kind of normalcy?
Yeah, I as you said, I don't know when that will take place, but what I think where the answer lies is when the government and the World Health Organization tells us that can take place again. I don't think anyone's going to just step out on their own and say, you know what, we're just going to put this thing together tonight. I don't think any organization is going to do that. And I think that there's going to be a time frame. Whether that time frame is 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, we don't know. And so those are the kinds of things that I think we need to have an awareness to. You know, from the work that, as you talked about, that I do with post-traumatic stress, what I talk about today is active traumatic stress. We're going through real-time trauma. So when that takes place, there's some emotional needs during uncertain times that I think are important. And it's about understanding yourself. Are you emotionally expressive or are you emotionally retentive? That's an important part, because if you're someone that holds it in, let me use an analogy. If I had a big balloon in front of us, how do I get the air out of the balloon? I could take a pin and pop it. I get the air out, but we don't have a balloon anymore. I can let it go. It flies all over the room. It goes out the back door. We don't know what happened to the balloon. But if I'm patient and willing to listen to sounds I don't want to hear, and I turn it upside down, and it makes that god-awful screeching noise, and I let a little air out, eventually I get all the air out. I have a full balloon I can use again one day. That's us with dealing with trauma. Our willingness and our capacities to share with others. Because when I share my feelings with you, I validate your feelings and give you permission to tell me your story. And what is personal is universal. There are no new emotions in this world. It's how we navigate them. So if there's a fear level, if there's anxiety, if all of these kinds of feelings, I'm not saying, you know, get up on a stage and talk about it. I'm talking about finding someone that you trust to have this conversation with is going to be extremely important. There's some other things. Develop a daily plan. Right now, I am writing down things every night around 9 o'clock, what I'm going to do the next day. I'm even laying clothes out of what I'm going to wear, because I don't want to be sitting around in my pajamas till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It creates an uneasiness, right? It's not norm. So make whatever you can as norm as possible and do that with scheduling. Think about positive thoughts. Now, I'm not saying all positive thoughts are make our life gumdrops and lollipops, but I do know negativity breeds negativity. And, you know, we talked about recognizing that change is difficult. Limit the social media that we talked about.
Yeah.
Schedule it.
Scheduling's huge, Bob. It's so big. It goes back to everything we know from our lessons through basketball. And I've been fighting that. I've been staying up late, either watching classic games or stuff that's going to make me laugh or the news. And this week especially were some scheduling challenges. But, I want to take it back, and you talk about, the positive and what brings us all together. Obviously, the game is positive and so many stories and experiences. And I was joking with BJ before the show started. They're playing all the hardwood classics now that there's no game action. So the 92 Bulls Blazers final game one was on yesterday. I told BJ how incredibly in shape he looked. And he was able to get in his stance and move his feet and everything. But, last week when I reached out to you, I had just watched clips of the classic Larry Bird Portland 1992 triple-double that you were officiating on that Sunday afternoon in Boston. And your memory of some of those moments which led to that miraculous shot were just unbelievable. They're exactly what I watched. So, to start us off, that time period where you're in the league, BJ comes in as a rookie in 89-90, the torch is passed from Magic and Larry to Michael and the Bulls. What were some of your favorite stories and experiences from that time? And, of course, anytime you can make fun of BJ in these stories, please feel free.
Always a consummate gentleman, right? And agreed with every one of my calls, so there's nothing I can say. if you go back to that game that you described, with that was Portland Blazers. They're playing on a Sunday afternoon, and it was March 16th or 15th. I can't remember either war, but I know that it was the celebration of St. Patrick's Day that would take place on either Monday or Tuesday. And so, it's back then it was probably in Boston CBS game. And Portland's winning as we're coming down the stretch in regulation. And it's a 7-point game with about 50 seconds to go. And somehow, some way, it gets down to a 3-point game with the take fouls going back and forth and people missing free throws and shots being made. And so now Jerome Kersey goes to the line with about 7-point-something seconds, way before we had replay available to us. Mm-hmm. And he misses the first. And on the second, while he makes it, he commits a line violation because he goes over the line knowing he misses. He's trying to get the rebound. And he's over the line before the ball is just about out of his hand, which you're not allowed to do. And I call the violation. So it gives the ball back to Boston down 3 with 7.2. They call a timeout. And all you hear during that entire time is that chant ringing through that old Boston Garden. Larry, Larry, Larry. So everybody knows who's getting the ball, right? I mean, it's not like there's going to be some great coaching going on this side. Everybody get out of the way and give it to Larry. And so the pass comes in. DJ takes care of making sure it gets in Larry's hands. And I'm in the slot position. And as Bird comes towards the slot, Clyde Drexler and Jerome are doubling him. And he goes up with a shot that he started from behind. You know how Larry would start from behind the line and land in front of the line? So you can get confused sometimes, but I was confident that he went from behind the line. I put my hand up. I stay watching to see if there is a foul. The ball goes in the hoop. And so now we got a tie game, and it's like about 2 seconds to go. It goes triple overtime, and as you said, the story. But here's what happens to start the first overtime. As Bird comes off for the jump ball, Hugh Evans I was working with and Jackie Neese, and Hugh Evans was going to throw the ball up for the first overtime. Bird comes right over to me, gets about nose to nose, and says, I should be on the line to end this thing. Now, there were a lot of other words between every word there that I don't want to put out, but there was a lot of descriptive words being used. But that was Larry setting it up for the next thing, right? He was always working, trying to get it, but he never did it in a way that it was boisterous. or he just looked like he's talking to you. But he in his mind, he was like, I got fouled in that thing, and I should have been on the line to end this thing. And he's always working as BJ will tell you, I mean, may have been one of the great trash talkers of all times. I mean, the guy always had a line for something. I mean, amazing.
So real quick before BJ chimes in with the next one, this is Larry Bird's last season, 49 points, 14 rebounds, 12 assists. But Bob, this is the reason when I played high school ball, started coaching at a young age, and just the way I watched the game, I would never, ever quit on a game because my father left the house with a minute to go down seven to go to Tower Record because he thought the game was over. Really? And I yelled and screamed at him for hours after he got home, and he felt like the biggest clown in the world. But that game is an incredible memory, and the fact that Larry said something to you going into overtime is of little surprise, obviously.
Exactly.
You and I both came in roughly right around the same time. I think your first season was 87, 88, right around there.
Yeah, I started in the CBA in 84 and then got hired into the NBA in 87.
Can you share with us here and our listeners about from the time you came in to the league as a young official and to the time you left as a seasoned veteran official, what was the biggest difference that you saw in the game, the preparation, players? What was the biggest difference from the time you came in to the time you left?
That was politely said. So you mean as I was a young guy versus an old dude, is what you said.
Very you were seasoned. You're very, as a player, you're experienced.
Yeah, I was real experienced to the point I couldn't run anymore. you know, all things change. And so the league changes as well. The game was a half-court game with probably the greatest centers that have ever been in the game. I saw Wilt Chamberlain play, but I never refereed him. I didn't referee Bill Russell, but you saw those guys play. But to officiate Patrick Ewing and Hakeem and David Robinson and Shaquille O'Neal, and the list goes on and on and on. Kareem, I mean, the center post. And you know, the game as it was set up to go inside was a different ball game. And you know, the spacing that took place when I first came in the league was phenomenal. When you think about Showtime and Magic coming down middle of the court, and Byron's running down one end, and James is down the other, and it's the classic 3-on-2 break, or the no look passes, all of that was just phenomenal. And then the game started to change. In the 90s, we went into the strong arm game. Everybody got in the weight room and everybody's taking a piece of somebody cutting through, mainly to slow plays down so to take time off the 24-second clock so that you can, the first and second option weren't going to be available to them. And then as the game continued all through my later years of being on the floor and then into the years that I was the vice president, referee operations director officials, that we had to adjust because it became a spread game. Everything was three-pointers. And so we had to adjust the officiating as well. Our referees are wider in the lead than they were because there's virtually no post play. So, and also the game was being pushed up the court so fast that even though we had three referees that was designed for more of a half-court game, we were ending up with only two referees in the front court because the ball was being pushed up so fast. So we had to adjust there as well. It's all about angles. It's all about open looks to be able to see the play, to be able to get to the best point of decision-making. If you see the beginning, middle, and end of a play in action, there's a better opportunity to make a decision whether to put air in the whistle or not. And all we're asking officials to do today is legal versus illegal contact. When I came in, what is advantage, disadvantage? But we changed that late 90s into the 2000s of saying it's just about legal versus illegal contact. That's all you should be. It's not about advantage, disadvantage, because quite honestly, if we have advantage, disadvantage, Mike, BJ, Eric, and Bob are going to have different views of what is a disadvantage or an advantage. And so what everyone calls for in officiating is consistency, what I refer to as calibration. We can only calibrate calls by the officials all thinking the same way. So if we give them the same self-talk and we tell them that speed, rhythm, quickness, and balance, when that's disrupted, is a foul when contact takes place, but there is no speed, quickness, rhythm, balance disrupted, that's a play on, we have a better chance of taking a 6-lane highway down to 2.5 lanes. We're never going to get to the 1-lane highway. It's a human factor that's involved with officiating and the game of basketball. But our hope is to be able to take a 6-lane highway, narrow it down to 2.5 lanes, and allow the athleticism of the greatest athletes in the world to take place within those guidelines.
When I look at those games that I played in that era, right? We always talk about it was tough and it was physical and the physicality. Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed. I go, God, someone really could have got hurt. In looking back at the game now, do you think we probably could have put in place more rules to limit the physicality of the game? In looking back on what we know now. Because I mean, when you look at some of the fouls when you look at some of the fouls that some of these guys were taking and how we played, and I mean, really, it was quite dangerous for the athletes, right? So, what's your take on that?
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I think that
you guys are both getting soft in your old age.
Well, BJ still looks like he's 17, so it doesn't matter, anyways, right? I mean,
this is true.
But I agree with you. I think that when we looked back and as time went on, it was a different era, and it's very difficult to compare eras.
Yes.
But if you're being reflective and you're being honest, there were things that, I mean, take that Mikhail and Rambis kind of hit that went on. That was a common foul. I mean, somebody may be indicted today for something like that.
As Bob Ryan said in the Celtics Lakers doc, shooting foul, go to the line.
I know. I mean, Bob, just think about that. That was a common foul. I mean,
common foul.
Assault.
Common foul. And, but true, you saw it firsthand of the Jordan rules. You saw the aggressiveness of taking somebody, no layups, that kind of play. And quite honestly, I think the NBA did the right thing in changing those. I know there's a lot of talk by the older guys at times and, you know, that things are softer, but there's a reality to we're so much more knowledgeable of what head injuries can do to folks and traumatic brain injuries that can come as a result of these kinds of contacts and how down the road it has an impact on a person's quality of life. So I think it's healthy. I also think what was healthy is when after that incident in San Antonio, when people came off the bench for the fight in the playoffs, I think that players were kind of relieved that they couldn't come from the bench. You know what I mean? Because you had to do it. Otherwise your teammates thought you were not behind them. Right. I mean, so you had to go fight. Otherwise, you're going to have a tough time in the locker.
You know, let's not forget the Bulls-Knicks fight in 94.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, you had to do something. And, you know, I wasn't the biggest guy. So what am I supposed to do if Charles Oakley or Anthony Mason or someone? I mean, what can you do? But I think it cleared up a lot of that because, I mean, as you know, these are some big people, right? I mean, Buck Williams and these guys. Like, what are you going to do? Like, with those guys.
Do you remember when Shaq and Charles had the fight in Houston? And Charles
I thought you were talking about him and Oakley. Yeah, I remember that.
No, Charles and Shaquille O'Neal.
Do you remember when Shaq and put him on the ground?
Right.
And they went back and forth. And let me tell you about how dumb I was. I was refereeing that game. I thought I was going to break up that fight. I got between the two of them. If you watch that closely, Mark Davis is working. He pulls me out of the pile by my shirt. 48 hours later, I was on an operating table because my meniscus tore as a result of trying to hold those two back from each other. And that kind of physicality, you think about it. If Shaq ever got mad, what could take place? I mean, thank God he has the demeanor that he has.
Yes, I said that all the time.
I believe he pulled a punch on Miller back in the day. You remember? Yeah. I think it was in Chicago.
It was in Chicago. Yeah, that's the one I thought you was referring to. Yeah, that was in Chicago. Yeah. If Shaq was a mean person,
yes, right,
he would have seriously hurt someone because he was
absolutely.
He was just so big and so strong.
Just if folks really cannot comprehend it unless you're seeing it firsthand. That man was I'll tell you, the first time I refereed Shaq when he was a rook, I was with Jack Madden. And Jack was an old-time referee who had refereed Wilt Chamberlain. And right. At the end of the game in the locker room, as we're taking showers and getting ready to hit the streets, he says, "I never thought I'd see anybody stronger than Wilt, and tonight I think I just did."
Wow. That's for sure.
Being able to connect the dots with the two generationally is unbelievable also. Remember that name from back in the day. So, you know, Bob, so many great players and games, and obviously we're all still reflecting, absorbing, reacting to the passing of Kobe Bryant. And I know you had some things to say about Kobe and did many of his games. What did he leave you with, and what were some of your favorite memories of, that relationship and refereeing? Just so much all time greatness on the floor that was around him.
I have shared this story with you. It was very emotional for the world, and I think there was a variety of reasons for that. I think it's a father and a daughter, and that while most of us either were in vans or cars with parents as kids or taking our own kids to games, there's a relatability. I think it was the story of so many people losing their lives that they struck this world so much. But I also believe that the NBA brings people around the TV as a family. And unfortunately, in today's society, we don't do as many things like that. And I think people bond it with parents and aunts and uncles and friends around watching, you know, whether it was Michael's era, Magic's era. But today, all the players there at the college, they grew up with Kobe. They felt like that was their buddy. That was their friend. Because while he may not have known them, they knew him. And that pain of loss, but also it's the pain of those kinds of memories are being shattered that struck us so strongly in the kind of work that I do emotionally, you know, of understanding what people think. But I shared with folks, there was a picture of Kobe wearing his Sunday white Laker uniform with me, and I start to laugh, and it was a still shot that went out pretty strong around the world. And what had happened was, it was early in the game on Sunday, and it was probably an NBC game, an ABC game back then, and it was a foul on Kobe probably in the first couple minutes, and I go to the trail, I give the signal, and now he starts walking to me with that scowl on his face that we all know that he could do. And I'm thinking, man, that was not a hard call. I mean, he hits the guy. What's he going to complain about now? My self-talk's going, and I'm preparing for some kind of, like, pushback argument. And he walks alongside me, stands, like, over me, and starts talking. And when watching the tape, Mike Green is saying, Kobe's giving Delaney an earful. He's not happy with that call. But what Kobe said was, what was that like wearing a wire when you're undercover? What was that like, man? That had to be wild. So he played me. He got me to laugh because I think he's coming to argue. He comes out with talking about the undercover stuff and the wire that I wore and all that. And BJ, I'll tell you, that's him. He knew everything he was doing at every moment, right? I mean, he orchestrated everything, and he was in control. And so those kinds of stories you remember. And, you know, while I never pretend to be friends per se, these working relationships and the opportunity to be around NBA players for generations. I got to talk to Willis Reed. I got to talk to Bill Russell. I mean, what a fortunate position I am in to have worked with the greatest athletes in the world and get the opportunity to spend 30 plus years around a game that we all love.
Bob, you brought up the undercover work and obviously your journey from that to the NBA to all the work that you've done with PTSD is just life-changing stuff. And as we continue to go through this, whether it's people in basketball, everyday people in society, responders, healthcare, people are going to be experiencing different forms and different levels of PTSD. So what is your number one top line thing for people to remember and how to deal with these feelings and emotions as they come about as we go through
the office? Identifying within yourself, if you're emotionally expressive or emotionally retentive, that would be number one. And having someone that you can speak with, because if you know that you hold things in, you're going to have some kind of self-talk to say, I'm going to let some of this out, because you can only carry it. So take that analogy I used with the balloon. If you keep filling the balloon up, eventually it's going to burst. And the more that we put ourselves in front of the TVs, the more that we think of these things negative, we start talking about the financial crisis that's coming. We're talking about, let's take it one step at a time. Let's have someone that we have a safe conversation with, that we can open up with, and stay away from the negativity. Allow yourself to monitor yourself, maintain the schedules, develop a pattern where you're saying 1 hour in the morning, 45 minutes in the morning, I'll watch the TV, 45 minutes in the afternoon, maybe 45 minutes at night, not start to finish in your pajamas all day long. Create routines so that you are now making sure that you're getting some kind of physical activity if you're capable, getting outside when it's safe to be outside, doing things that are going to create some kind of feeling of normalcy, even though we're in the abnormal. And that's our responsibility to each other. I always say, you know, these are like shadows. There's shadows in everybody's life. But never fear a shadow, because if there's a shadow, that means there's light nearby. Our responsibility to ourselves, our families, and to each other is to get to that light.
Beautiful way to close it. Appreciate you, Bob. Thanks for taking the time.
My honor. Pleasure to be with you guys. You stay safe.
Bob. All right. You too, Bob. Thank you so much. And hey, I miss our back and forth. I miss all of the stuff, and I wish we could have still get out there and still run around, but I'm done. My knees are done.
BJ, it's funny that you say that. It's like I feel the same way. Wouldn't it? It's a blink. The career is over in a blink. And yet I would love to be out on the floor with you, but it's always an honor working your games. You're not only a hell of an athlete and an amazing basketball player, you're a good, good man.
All right, thank you, Bob. I appreciate it. And the same to you and your family. Be safe, my friend.
Stay healthy, stay safe, take care of each other. I'll see you down the road.
Yep.
Thanks, Bob.
Take care.
So, BJ, obviously, we love talking to different people on the show, but there is only one Bob Delaney. And yes. I know your journey in the league, you had a lot of interactions with him and what seems like a great relationship.
Yeah, he, you know, as I was, yes, we were having the, you know, the conversation, the interview with him, with Bob, it just, you know, things come up, right? And one of the things I miss more than anything was
you actually would have conversations with the referee during the course of the game. And you began to develop relationships with, you know, the people. And as I was thinking throughout the interview, it was like, God, I miss Bob. I miss talking to him. I miss like trash talking with him. I miss that interaction. It was like you're hanging out with one of the guys. It was kind of like we all had a role. We all understood the business. We understood our roles in this business. And then I started to think about Bennett Salvatore and Dick Bavetta and Steve Javy and all of these people. And they just like, I was like, I miss these people. Like, I want to call them, because it was, you know, I had a real relationship with Bob. And if I needed something, I knew I could talk to him. He would talk back to me. And there was a mutual respect that you had in that era with players and teams. And I mean, to hear him just talk about the game was too physical. Yeah, it really was. But we all understood how to navigate and play our role in that era, right? We were probably all thinking the same thing, but we all understood how to help one another in that time. And he was a terrific referee. I mean, he was an excellent referee. And there were many in that era, because you always knew when you were on the road, you're going to get a fair whistle. And that's all you could ask. And it was a pleasure catching up with him. And every time I see him, you know, we always hug and spend a couple of minutes. I see him and he's doing great work around the league and with the leagues still currently. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And some valuable messaging too, that I'm definitely going to print out and put up on the fridge as a reminder, as we continue to navigate these uncertain several weeks ahead. So, always great to chop it up with you, buddy. So
yeah. Well, I want to say this before we end the show. You know, it's really one of the funny things, because my dad was a referee. It's funny to hear that the referees are listening to all of the trash talking too. I thought that was funny when he said about Larry Bird. I was like, wait a minute, you're supposed to be referee in the game. He's listening to the trash talking too. So I mean, that was just great. I didn't want to like make a big deal about that, but the fact that he's listening to the trash talking, that's just classic.
That's part of all the magic in the relationship building, you know, and the fact we've seen so many heated exchanges and conflicts today between players and refs because they haven't established that kind of relationship and respect. And I think that's unfortunately something that left the game a number of years ago. And it's something that I think would help the game if it was back now, because there would be more of an understanding from both sides, because I think referees are too quick with some of these technical foul calls. I think there's obviously way too much complaining from players. And I think there needs to be more of an understanding and relationship between both sides, which was evident in the world that you navigated and Bob Delaney navigated. There's no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, look, we could go on and on, but I will say this. You know, when you were playing in the game in that era, and I think I can speak for that era of basketball, the referees were a part of that game. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the players. It wasn't like, you know, everyone had a role to play. And when you knew a Steve Javy was refereeing a game, or Jory Crawford or Bob Delaney, when you knew those guys were there, you had to adjust to that, the way that game was going to be officiated. The coaches had to adjust. The players had to adjust. And there was a mutual respect. I don't know what it was, but I know it was something that was there. And, you know, I that came with age and experience, right? You know, I don't know if I was 19 or 20, I would have got that. But when I was in the league and I came to the league at 21, 22, and 2 or 3 years later, when I was, you know, 23, 24, I got it. So I just think it's a different time and a different era. But I really miss those guys. I miss those guys telling me, BJ, the game is a little bit too physical tonight. Make sure you just pull up. I mean, I mean, I was just thinking of all of the conversations that you had, and you would just be talking to guys during the game. And I mean, when you had an excellent official would tell you, you know, you're standing at the free throw line somewhere, and he goes, "Hey, BJ, I missed that call. I missed that call. My bad." Yeah. Like, and you weren't upset about it. You were like, "Okay, you missed the call. Hey, I missed the play. Everyone's on." I wasn't trying to show him up. He wasn't trying to show me up. And that's the type of back and forth that you had back then. Because I don't know how it happened, but I was thinking of those guys. It was like a dance. I don't know, but they were part of the dance for sure. And that was a fun time.
Good stuff, my man. Great job today. Special thanks as always to first team All Pro producer Mike Lieber.
Yes.
The one and only Bruce Bernstein, editor Benjamin Wolfen, and the entire Pure Hoops media fam and team. We are sticking with our show schedule the best we can. Coming at you next week, the Mike Wise Show. We've got full court press with Fanta and Adams. Hopefully, if schedules allow, Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Aaron Berlin and Otto Strong, Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with the one and only Monica McNutt, and the Pure Hoops podcast with BJ Armstrong and myself. We'll be back next week. We're going to continue to navigate this uncertain time. We're going to continue to tell stories, have insightful conversations, find a few minutes for some good laughs, and most importantly, stay pure.
The Pure Hoops podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.